Hi, and welcome to the Norwalk Hour for Wednesday, October 30th. I'm Brian Burgess, and we'll begin with the front page article headlined, Norwalk Celebrates Start of Downtown Rebirth. This article by Colleen Rose Ozanek. As construction vehicles and an excavator lined Irving Freeze Park, city officials and lawmakers celebrated the groundbreaking of a $27 million project to revitalize the Wall Street downtown area. With $22.25 million in city, state, and federal funding already secured, the first phase of the Norwalk revitalization will focus on Wall Street from Brook Street to Main Street. It will add pedestrian-level lighting, brick amenity zones, a raised crosswalk, a decorative arch over the roadway, trees, and a revamped streetscape optimized for pedestrians, bicyclists, and motorists by the fall of 2025. We're going to bring this back to a thriving, vibrant area in which the city and the city's residents and the business area down here can be very, very proud, Mayor Harry Rilling said. The first phase of the development is just one part of the Wall Street Renaissance, said State Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff of Norwalk. Within what Duff coined as the Year of Wall Street are updates to Freeze Park and the long-awaited Wall Street Place for housing development. The neighborhood had struggled mightily and fell into disrepair after the 1955 flood, Rilling said. After the flood, my dad would drive me around, the mayor said. There was a building that was collapsed, and you could still see the bathtubs and everything hanging on the plumbing. But with the collaboration of state, local, and federal governments, Rilling said, the Wall Street downtown will be reborn. This may end up being really the jewel of Norwalk, said U.S. 4th District Representative Jim Himes. Construction on the first phase of the revitalization will begin next week, according to Jim Travers, director of the city's Transportation, Mobility, and Parking Department. Crews will work through the winter as weather permits, resume construction in the spring, and close out in the fall, Travers said. Four total phases are planned in the Wall Street revitalization effort, though timeline details past the first segment weren't yet available. The project is funded by two Connecticut Department of Transportation Local Transportation Capital Improvement Program grants, totaling $9.4 million. A $3.5 million state urban action grant, $250,000 in American Rescue Plan Act funds, $1.6 million from the city, and $2 million from its parking authority, and $5.5 million in community project funding from the U.S. Department of Transportation. More funding is necessary, and officials are looking to bring in more for the project, which will likely value $27 million once completed, Travers said. And in another front-page article by Colleen Rose Ozanek, Duff faces criticism for Instagram post comparing Trump to Hitler. After facing accusations of anti-Semitism, State Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff is defending an Instagram reel he shared comparing former President Donald Trump to Adolf Hitler. Republicans have decried the post and demanded that Duff apologize for the video, which the senator said he posted Sunday after someone sent it to him. I think it has a lot of value and a lot of parallels to what is happening today, Duff said of the video. The five-minute reel interposed some of Trump's historically controversial statements between footage from Nazi-era Germany and modern clips, including the rioters wearing Trump merchandise and bearing Confederate flags during the January 6, 2021 insurrection on the United States Capitol, and white nationalists chanting, "Jews will not replace us," at the 2017 Charlottesville Unite the Right rally. The Nazi-era clips from Germany include Hitler speaking at podiums, Nazi rallies, German Holocaust-era propaganda depicting Jewish stereotypes, graffiti that said, "Beware Jew" in German, and a Nazi soldier painting the Star of David on a window font. Duff posted the video in response to the Trump rally at Madison Square Garden this weekend with the following caption. While the fascist rally starring Hitler 2.0 is ongoing at Madison Square Garden, I thought this would be a good time to post this video. To all voters, democracy versus dictatorship, Freedom versus Fascism. Drew Todd, a Norwalk resident, said using clips of Nazi-era Germany and Jews in the anti-Trump video is anti-Semitic. I don't care how much you hate Trump, said Todd, who's among others criticizing Duft's post on social media and in public statements. The Connecticut Republican Party issued a statement Tuesday condemning Duff and demanding an immediate apology for the video that dangerously distorts history and insults the memory of those who perished under the Nazi regime. State Senator Rob Sampson of Walcott issued a statement condemning Duff's reel for hateful anti-Semitic rhetoric. In response, Duff encouraged his critics to think about Trump's historical statements. Think about how he said that there are very fine people on both sides in Charlottesville, Duff said, referring to the 2017 Unite the Right rally. After that rally, in a press conference, a reporter mentioned neo-Nazis, to which Trump said there were some very bad people in that group, but you also had people that were very fine people on both sides. Duff said that Trump is a fascist and that his beliefs and ideologies are dangerous to Americans. He expressed concern over Trump's statement that voting would no longer be necessary. Duff specifically compared the Madison Square Garden rally, where a speaker called Puerto Rico a floating island of garbage, to the 1939 rally the German-American Bund organized in support of the rise of Nazism. Duff also referred to John Kelly, Trump's former chief of staff, who said recently that the former president met the definition of a fascist. The video included a quote from Trump where he said, "Immigrants are poisoning the blood of our country." In Hitler's autobiographical political manifesto, the dictator referred to interracial relationships as the blood poisoning of Germans. Duff said Trump's above statements were indicative of fascism, a political ideology characterized by ultranationalism and authoritarianism. While the state Senate Majority Leader said that Trump's statement should give the country pause, Todd disagreed and said that Trump's mouth is often engaged before his brain and that the former president is not dangerous. If Connecticut and Norwalk Republicans want to defend Donald Trump, have at it, Duff said. I'll defend democracy. Todd said that while some of Trump's language may galvanize bad actors, the country is capable of rejecting them. There are some people in the Republican Party that have really taken things a little to the extreme, Todd said. I think there's enough people in our party, in our country, that would disavow that in 3 seconds. And in a front page article by Christine Dempsey, Bannon is released Tuesday from a Connecticut prison. In Danbury, former Donald Trump advisor Steve Bannon was released from prison here Tuesday, after which he wasted no time jumping back into politics, with hopes of getting Trump elected president during the final week of the campaign. Bannon was released from the Federal Correctional Institution in Danbury on Pembroke Road Tuesday morning, said Benjamin O'Cone, spokesperson for the Federal Bureau of Prisons. He has served the entirety of his sentence, O'Cone said. Bannon went to New York City and appeared on his podcast, The War Room, at 10 a.m., where he said prison had a positive effect on him. "The 4 months I spent in prison empowered me," Bannon said. "I'm more energized and more focused than I have ever been in my entire life." He thanked the staff for keeping the podcast going, saying, "I've never been prouder of the production team." Bannon talked about the importance of supporting Trump in his fight for the presidency and said, "If the U.S. Representative Nancy Pelosi apparatus wins, you better be prepared to go to federal prison." Tuesday afternoon, Bannon held a news conference in New York City. "I'm finally out of being a political prisoner by the U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland, Vice President Kamala Harris, Nancy Pelosi regime," he said, "for standing up for my political beliefs against an illegitimate committee," Bannon said. "The system is broken, including the Bureau of Prisons. This is not about Danbury. Many good individuals working at the Danbury Federal Prison," he noted. "The system of the Bureau of Prisons, the system of the Justice Department, is broken." In prison, Bannon said that he listened to working-class minorities, including Black, Hispanic, and Puerto Rican men. He also thanked the prison's education department, which he said allowed him to teach civics and government to close to 100 students in 3 different classes. The Bureau of Prisons declined to comment on the conditions of confinement for any individual in their custody for privacy, safety, and security reasons. However, a representative with the agency said, "There are many opportunities for individuals in our custody to teach, mentor, and tutor others. These can include adults in custody being assigned as tutors or teaching adult continuing education courses." Bannon, being prisoner number 05635-509, was listed as released from Danbury Federal Correctional Institution on October 29th. The 70-year-old reported to prison on July 1st after the Supreme Court rejected his bid to delay the sentence while he appeals his conviction. A jury found him guilty in 2022 of 2 counts of contempt of Congress. One count was for refusing to participate in a deposition with the January 6th House Committee, and the second was for refusing to provide documents related to his involvement with Trump's alleged efforts to overturn his loss to Joe Biden in the 2020 presidential race. Bannon was almost jubilant when he reported to prison on July 1st, saying, "I am proud to go to prison." He started a "Next Man Up" chant, an apparent reference to his War Room podcast and the Make America Great Again movement. He was surrounded by a group of supporters holding flags and signs, including one that read, "Free Bannon." U.S. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia was among the people in the crowd supporting him. His sentence was 120 days, according to AmericasVoice.com, which live-streamed Bannon's arrival at FCI Danbury in July. Elsewhere, a Darien High grad leaves $25,000 to his former school library. This front-page article by Molly Hirsch. A $25,000 gift in memory of a 1952 Darien High School graduate will go on to help future generations of readers, just like he was. The family of Donald Woody Gray donated the money to the Darien High School Library, which Gray bequeathed to the school as part of his will. Of the funds, $8,000 will go toward new books in the library to help build up the district's emphasis on independent book choice units, especially for senior year elective English courses. "It is an honor for us to be offered this generous gift from Carolyn McLear in memory of her father," Darien High School Principal Ellen Dunn said during an October 22nd Board of Education meeting, where the gift was accepted. "He was an avid reader who spent much of his time in the Darien High School Library." Also from today's front page, student loan borrowers owe $18.6 billion as grace period ends. This article by Alex Putterman. Over recent years, student debt has shifted from a quiet burden borne by borrowers nationwide to a hotly debated political issue with implications for elections this fall in Connecticut and across the country. At the federal level, President Joe Biden has sought to forgive loans for millions of Americans, only to be thwarted repeatedly by lawsuits from Republican-led states. Currently, multiple major loan forgiveness proposals are in limbo as courts decide whether to allow them to proceed. Meanwhile, a grace period for student loan repayment ended at the start of October, meaning borrowers will again face consequences for failing to make payments. In Connecticut, lawmakers have created a $6 million pilot program through which residents who volunteer at a local nonprofit can earn up to $20,000 in debt forgiveness, and have launched a program to cancel up to $50,000 in loans for qualifying health care workers. They also voted last year to fund a new student loan ombudsman, though the position has not yet been filled. How broad an issue is student debt in Connecticut? Who holds the most debt, and how do we compare to other states? $18.6 billion. That's the amount of student debt held by 507,200 borrowers in Connecticut, according to federal data. And because the locations of borrowers are not reported to the government in all cases, the true total is likely higher. Connecticut accounts for about 1.2% of all debt nationwide, excluding that for which no location is available, slightly higher than its share of the overall U.S. population. How much is $18.6 billion? It's nearly as much as Connecticut's entire state budget for the 2025 fiscal year, just shy of the estimated net worth of the state's wealthiest resident and more than three times the payroll of every Major League Baseball team put together in 2024. $36,671.92. That's the average student debt per Connecticut borrower, 21st highest of any state. Maryland borrowers have the highest average debt burden at $43,692.23, while those in North Dakota have the lowest at $29,646.52. Among fellow northeastern states, Connecticut's average is lower than that of New York, New Jersey, and Vermont, but higher than that of Massachusetts, Maine, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island. 39,000. That's the number of people in Connecticut who owe at least $100,000 in loans, accounting for about 8% of borrowers overall, but 27% of all debt. That group includes 11,600 people who owe more than $200,000. About 40% of Connecticut borrowers, just under 200,000 people in total, owe between $5,000 and $20,000 in loans, while another 23% owe between $20,000 and $40,000. About 12% of borrowers owe less than $5,000. 25 to 34, that's the age group most likely to hold student loans in Connecticut. According to federal data, 174,300 people in this age range have student debt, totaling about $6 billion in loans. Borrowers aged 35 to 49 also have about $6 billion in student debt, while those aged 50 to 61 hold about $3.4 billion in debt. Older and younger groups have plenty of debt, too, $1.6 billion held by about 100,000 people, 24 and younger, and another $1.6 billion held by about 30,000 people, 62 and older. And in a related story, recapping the CSCU spending controversy. This article by Jacqueline Rabe Thomas. Three separate probes were launched late last week into the spending habits of the leader of the state's largest public college system in the wake of a CT Insider investigation published on Thursday. Governor Ned Lamont called Connecticut State Colleges and Universities Chancellor Terrence Cheng's spending tone-deaf when announcing the state comptroller was opening an investigation. House Democratic legislative leaders called the spending troubling and promised a legislative probe of the spending and asked the system to freeze his ability to charge anything until records are released. The state auditor's office said it would open a separate probe at the request of Senate Republicans, who said that the tone-deaf champagne tastes of Chancellor Cheng are not a good look for the chancellor for the CSCU system. Terrence Cheng, chancellor of the state's dozen community colleges, four regional state universities, and online state college, regularly charged accounts funded by state taxpayers and student tuition dollars for expensive meals and for a handful of chauffeurs, according to records obtained by the CT Insider. Many of these pricey meals were with other state employees, including his own staff, employees at other public college systems, and members of the Lamont administration. In the course of reviewing some of Cheng's business expenses and benefits, CT Insider came across numerous expenses that Cheng and university officials say are permissible spending. But experts and good governance groups say that some of the spending is insensitive and politically fraught given the fiscal pressures facing the CSCU system he oversees. During an interview, Cheng insisted his spending and benefits are typical in higher education. But a rundown of the chancellor's office total business expenses shows that during Cheng's administration, his office expenses through June, on average, were more than twice his predecessor's, almost $202,000 in annual spending versus about $80,000 a year. Spending on meals was also 60% higher under Cheng. Hours after the CT Insider story published online Thursday morning detailing Chen's spending and benefits, there were bipartisan calls for an investigation from legislators. The spending of the CSCU chancellor is troubling and raises questions about whether state rules or laws have been violated, reads a joint statement from House Democratic leaders. The chairman of the board that oversees CSCU also announced that he has ordered the chancellor to change his spending habits, and Cheng said that he plans to do so. On Friday, a CSCU spokesman announced a series of reforms. Going forward, the Connecticut Board of Regents is providing additional oversight of system office spending. Additionally, CSCU is in the final stages of hiring a new chief compliance officer, as well as a new general counsel. Once they are on the job, Chancellor Cheng will instruct both individuals to initiate a review of CSCU's P-card, or state-funded credit card, and travel policies. A college system spokesman said Friday that officials there plan to diligently provide all information requested by CT Insider, as well as for the three investigations. In other news, an inmate suit leads a state to amend policy on smudging. This article by Jesse Leavenworth. The Department of Correction has changed its policy on inmates' practice of an ancient ritual after a convicted felon and self-described Wiccan sued the state. Daniel Wine, who was sentenced to 29 years in prison in 2016 after the Vernon man was convicted of multiple felonies tied to sexual contact with a minor, contended in his suit against Governor Ned Lamont and other state officials that a policy limiting smudging denied his right to practice religion under a First Amendment and federal civil rights law. Smudging is a purification ritual rooted in Native American cultures that involves burning sage, cedar sweetgrass, and other materials, which have been sold in starter witch kits. Smoke from the burning herbs and resins is meant to heal, bless, and protect people against negative energy. When Wine sued in February 2023, the only religion allowed to practice smudging in Connecticut prisons was Native American, Assistant Attorney General James W. Donahue wrote in a recently filed motion to dismiss Wine's complaint. However, as of October 3rd, the policy now also accommodates other faith groups that practice the rite, making Wine's lawsuit moot, Donahue wrote. The case is set for a hearing in Hartford Superior Court on December 16th. In his complaint, Wine names several other practicing Wiccan inmates who he claims were wrongly banned from smudging. The amended policy says inmates must buy smudging materials from the prison commissary, and that materials such as toilet paper are not to be used. Sage and other authorized smudging materials must be burned outside during designated smudge time. Attempting to inhale the ritual smoke is not allowed, and those who violate the policy can be removed from the smudging program for at least 6 months, with all existing supplies disposed of, according to the policy. Often associated with paganism and witchcraft, Wicca is defined by Merriam-Webster Dictionary as a religion influenced by pre-Christian beliefs and practices of Western Europe that affirms the existence of supernatural power, such as magic, and of both male and female deities who inhere in nature and that emphasizes ritual observance of seasonal and life cycles. And in an article by Tim McGill, a warm Halloween is coming 4 years after a 21-degree low. From freezing morning lows to possible record-breaking highs, a big warm-up in Connecticut this week sets us up for an unseasonably warm Halloween. Temperatures are expected to bounce back to near 80 degrees by Thursday afternoon after tumbling into the upper 20s in colder interior portions of Connecticut on Sunday night. Just 4 years ago, trick-or-treaters had to really bundle up on Halloween Day when the low hit 21 degrees, the coldest temperature ever on record for the last day of October in Hartford. The record coldest maximum temperature there was 41 degrees in 1925. The hottest Halloween on record in Hartford occurred in 1946, when the high temperature soared to 82 degrees, a spooky 24 degrees above average, according to the National Weather Service. It might be a little scary to some trick-or-treaters how rapidly October nights have been warming since 1970. Climate Central analyzed 242 cities and found that 216 of them, 89%, had warmed by an average of 3.3 degrees during that span. Hartford's fall nights have exceeded that average, having warmed up more than 5 degrees over the past 54 years. October is a transition month. Summer-like weather still surges northward along the East Coast, but colder, wintry weather can also crash southward into New England. Only the hardiest trick-or-treaters braved that spooky weather that socked Connecticut with heavy snow in 2011. Governor Daniel Malloy declared a state of emergency. The Halloween nor'easter that hit 13 years ago was referred to by many names, including Oktoberblast, Shocktober, and Snowtober. The Northeast Regional Climate Center referred to it as the Great October Snowstorm. Sunshine and a southwest breeze should send temperatures soaring into the middle to upper 70s for most of the state, around 15 to 20 degrees above average. Hartford's record high of 82 degrees for October 31st is within reach. Bridgeport's record high for the date of 75 and New Haven's record on Halloween of 73 could also fall. The forecast temperatures for prime trick-or-treating time will start off in the lower 70s around 5 p.m. and fall into the lower to middle 60s by 9 p.m. Dry conditions are expected with possible rain from an approaching cold front not arriving until after midnight. And continuing in this theme, in an article by Lily Ionella, a report pinpoints the state's most popular Halloween candy for 2024. Of all the kid-friendly Halloween events in Connecticut this year, for some, one activity tops them all: trick-or-treating. Weather forecasts predict an unseasonably warm Halloween for Connecticut, with temperatures near 80 degrees on Thursday afternoon, which might entice trick-or-treaters to go out and seek their favorite candies. To help figure out which candies to buy, CandyStore.com, an online retailer specializing in bulk candy, creates annual state-by-state rankings for the most sought-after sweets using the store's sales data. From coast to coast, some choices might surprise you, with others will make you question your neighbor's taste at Bud's, the retailer said in its 2024 rankings. Knowing what's hot in your state is crucial if you want to avoid the candy faux pas this year. According to a 2024 Halloween spending survey by the National Retail Federation, handing out candy is the top celebration plan for Halloween Day, and total spending on candy nationwide is predicted to reach $3.5 billion. For the past 2 years, the top candy in the Nutmeg State has been one that has its roots in Connecticut. Here's what CandyStore.com ranked as this year's most popular Halloween candies in Connecticut using 17 years of sales data from 2007 to 2024. CandyStore.com found Almond Joy is the most popular candy in Connecticut. Only one other state, Missouri, ranked Almond Joy as its top candy, according to the retailer. The candy also topped the CandyStore.com's 2023 rankings in Connecticut. Almond Joy, which is made of coconut, chocolate, and almonds, has a Connecticut connection. It was invented in Connecticut by the Peter Paul Candy Company, whose production facility was originally located in New Haven and Naugatuck. Milky Way, a nougat topped with caramel and chocolate, came in second in CandyStore.com's 2024 rankings for the most popular Halloween candies. And according to CandyStore.com, M&Ms are the third most popular candy in Connecticut in 2024. The candy dethroned Reese's Cups as the top Halloween candy nationwide for the first time ever, according to the retailer. Finally today, in Life Tributes, Elisa A. Kachan of Fairfield passed away peacefully on October 26th. Joanne Madeline Stolarski of Norwalk peacefully passed away on October 27th. And Eleanor P. Totillo of Seymour entered into eternal rest on October 22nd. And that's all the time we have for today. I'm Brian Burgess, and you've been listening to the Wednesday, October 30th edition of the Norwalk Hour. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.